Thank you. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carolina Beach Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is May the 13th, 1973. After the sobriety countdown last night, prior to that, I thought that I'd been in AA a little while, but after that countdown, everybody at the table looked at me and said, "Go get the coffee." Yeah. I am really grateful to be here. I can't tell you what a wonderful experience it's been, and the closing ceremonies were so moving. I'm always a little concerned when I speak after the closing ceremonies. I don't know if there's a message there or not. I think it means if you got anything else to do, go do it. Julie and I have been here since Monday, and it's been a near perfect time. We've played golf and walked by the golf and just done a variety of things, really marvelous things in your beautiful, beautiful town. And in every life, though, a little rain must fall. And unfortunately, Tuesday, I made the newspaper. It seems that our room was broken into and my computer was stolen. So while I'm speaking, my wife, Julia, will be passing through the audience with a basket. The committee's looking nervous. I'm just kidding. Oh, what a great, great time we've had. I want to thank Debbie and Joe and everybody who's been so good. And Reed has just been a marvelous host. He's been very attentive to all our needs. I did much better than Clancy did. And we've just had a marvelous time. I want to thank you all very much. It's good to see so many old friends. I have been in Florida fairly often the last couple of years, and I always love coming here. I just like the way you do things. And I can't add to the emotion of a few moments ago, but I would like to say that I've been to a lot of these things, and this is as fine a convention as any I've ever been to. And I want to congratulate you and thank you for allowing me to be part of it. I was born in a small town in Ohio. I've lived in North Carolina for some years now. I know I don't sound like it, but I'm working on that. But I was born in a small town in Ohio, and I'm Irish. I'm the eldest son, the second child, in a family of 10 children. I won't tell you what church I went to. I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say it anymore. Okay. I so enjoyed Clancy's talk last night. I've heard Clancy many times, as has everyone, but you're a vicious bunch, you know that? I meant absolutely nothing derogatory by that remark, and I just meant he's been around a long time, and been somewhere a long time, hadn't he? See, I am after Clancy, and so I can say whatever I want to say. Because Clancy's an old-timer, and funny things happen to old-timers. I don't know if it's the smoke or the coffee or what, but they forget a lot, and so the next time that I run into Clancy, he will have forgotten everything I've said. There are a lot of old-timers. I was just really overwhelmed. Meeting Eddie was a real honor, and I just can't say enough about old-timers. Though if you're new, I feel it fair to warn you that old-timers aren't everything they're cracked up to be. They have a few quirks that it might be useful to know about. One of them is Clancy says that he continues to come back to meetings because he needs to, and that's just not true. Clancy comes back because the only enjoyment that these people get out of life is watching people like you and me suffer. And it's really true, and if you don't believe that, take a problem to one of them. They love it when you have problems. And the first thing they'll do is laugh. Whatever the problem is, the first thing they do is they laugh. And they really like it if you're having sex problems. And the answer is always the same. Don't have any. You know, most of them aren't having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have sex either. So. I'll get on with it now. Seriously, I was just... I spent quite a bit of time last night before I went to sleep thinking about some of the things that Clancy had said and Doug. It's so very, very true. You know, there was something different about me. I'm not saying I'm different now, but there was something different about the way I viewed life. And I'm convinced that this has happened to me as a very, very small child. And I don't know why, and furthermore, I don't care. It's absolutely irrelevant to me. I agree that knowing why something's the way it is about as useful as having a license number of the truck that hit you. You know, it's interesting, but you'd probably be better off with an ambulance. But I think it's kind of interesting to know that at one time, I reacted differently to life than other people. And I'm convinced I know why. I'm convinced it's because I had a horrible soul illness, a spiritual illness called fear. And I don't know where it came from, and I don't know how I seem to get more of it than other people, but I just had a lot of it. I had it from a very early age. There was something that lived under my bed. And nobody else knew it was down there, but I knew it was there. I never asked anybody about it, and I sure never told anybody about it, because one of the things that goes with fear is keeping it a secret. But I knew intuitively, I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed, and that was history. I knew that. I'd disappear, and I'd never reappear. And I don't know if the world would stop going around or something bad would happen. My parents would just give up on life. But I knew that if that thing ever got me, I was a goner. And I just intuitively knew that. And that's the way it was. And nothing would ever penetrate that fear until I ran into booze. You know, I remember I played second base in the Little League. And I was a good ball player because my father spent a lot of time with my brother Danny and I teaching us to play baseball. And I remember we were in the championship game, and there was a man on second and third, and there were no outs. And they hit a ground ball to me, and I just didn't want them to hit that ground ball to me. And I scooped it up, and it was sort of instinctive, and I threw the man out at home plate. And now there were one out and a man on third base. And then the next man hit a line drive over second, and I got over there and I picked it off. But I didn't want him to hit it at me. I wanted him to hit it at somebody else because I knew I'd blow it. But I caught the line drive, I backhanded it, and I doubled the man off third base, and the game was over and we won the championship. And the next time I played ball, I knew that I'd blow it. I just knew it was a matter of time. And I lived with that sort of fear, that soul sickness. And that's just the way I approached life. I just knew it was going to go wrong. And nobody ever told me that. I'd love to blame my parents and the nuns and everybody. Oh, slip. But I just can't, you see, because my life is my responsibility. And my parents and everybody else did the best they could with what they had. And I'd love to be a victim of something, but I just can't pull it off. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't work anymore. And that's one of the great crimes of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you work these steps, it'll rob you of the opportunity to be a victim. You know, I was really enjoying it. I was really enjoying myself Tuesday when I found out somebody had stolen my computer. I really was. I mean, I was wronged, and how could this happen, and this wonderful hotel, and the whole shooting match. And that was good for about 5 hours or so. And finally, I said to Julie, I said, this has gone on long enough. I got to pray for that person who stole my computer. So I went on out on the balcony, and I prayed a rosary for whoever it was. And, And if they need to be in this room, by God, I hope they make it here. I hope they make it here soon. And one day I hope they have to do an eighth and ninth step. And maybe they'll drop Bob a note and get a tape. And maybe they'll put two and two together. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, the reality of the situation is that if you're going to live this life and work this program, you can't be a victim. It just doesn't work. You have to exclude yourself if you want to remain a victim. And I think the key to all of that, Doug said it so well Friday night. If you missed that talk, it's one of the great talks. There's more information in there than I got in 4 years of college. So I'm going to have to buy the tape and listen to it over a period of time. But it was absolutely marvelous talk. And one of the things he pointed out in that talk was that the key to this freedom is the eighth and ninth step. All the steps, of course, but eight and nine is the real key to this freedom. And it was in the eighth and ninth step that I realized that I had a choice. And my choice was I could continue to be a victim and thus victimize myself. Or I could change that and I could begin to look at the way things really were. And start judging people by the same ruler I use on myself. When I'm a victim, it means that I'm a special case, and it means that I'm judging you or others differently than I judge myself. And on any level, that's self-centeredness. On any level, to me, that's the bondage of self. I don't know the outcome of these things. You know, I like to talk a little bit about how different I was from my brothers and sisters. And one of the first times I realized this was the first time I drank. And some of you know about my brother, Dumb Denny, and some of you don't. So I'm going to share about Denny. We're not proud of Denny, but Denny was with me the first time I drank. My father was watching Denny and I. I was five and Denny was four, and my mother was out. I don't know if she was at the bingo or having a baby or something. And Dad was watching us. And we were sitting out in the kitchen around the table playing games and things. And I think he just thought it'd be kind of cute. So he got us a beer. It was rarely alcohol in our house. But there were a few beers in the refrigerator. And Dad got them out. And he gave one to me. And he took one. And he gave one to Dumb Denny. And we drank them. And he was watching us. And that's fine. But Denny slid out of the chair and he was rolling around under the table singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs and Dad kind of panicked and so he grabbed Denny and he took him upstairs and he took his clothes off and he put his jammies on him and he put him in bed and he said to me, "Get ready for bed, son." And I said, "Okay, Dad." And he said, "Don't say anything to your mother about this." And I said, "Okay, Dad." And I was willing to go along, but Denny wasn't hearing it. He was laughing and carrying on and singing and having the best time. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. Oh, Denny stood up in his little crib across the room from me, and he urinated on the floor. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. But, Denny just never really developed beyond that point. It was an awful thing. He did some strange things. He grew up. I'll give you some examples. Denny grew up and he went to one college. It gets worse. He had one major. And he graduated in 4 years, just like it says in the book. And he went to one graduate school, and you guessed it. He graduated on time and had a 4.0 average or something. And he got like 7 or 8 really good job offers, and he took one. And he's been working for this one corporation now, for a large international corporation, for something over 25 years. And he's an officer in this huge, probably one of the largest corporations in the world, senior vice president. You know, the most disgusting thing of all is he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands, when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers, you know. You know, things were hard for me. I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. You know, this fear has this spiritual illness, this soul sickness, this thing called fear that causes me to focus so much on me, makes me spend all my time wondering how I feel about things, or what I think about things, or how does this affect me. Okay? The thing is so consuming that it dictated virtually every aspect of my life. I rarely dated the people I wanted to date growing up, because I would only ask the people out who I thought wouldn't say no. And, you know, even after I was sober, I was 29 years old, and my wife had requested that I vacate the earth, and so I was sober a little while, and my sponsor came to me, and he said, I think it's time for you to date, and I said, why? He says, well, you drool a lot when you... And he said... And I was telling him about this nurse at the hospital. I was stalking her, you know how you... Guys, some of you guys know what I'm talking about. You know, you stalk someone, and I don't think you women probably don't know this, but I'll fill you in. When you stalk someone, what you do is you watch them, and you try to figure out how they're watching you, right? And then you try to compare that with how they're looking at other guys, see? And then you eliminate any possibility of rejection. Until you're absolutely sure, you know, they start tearing your clothes off you or something like that. And then it's safe to ask them for coffee, okay? Because you don't want to risk rejection. And so my sponsor told me to ask this woman out, and I said, well, I couldn't do that. And he said, why? I said, well, I don't know, but I just couldn't. And so he said, do it or I'll break your knee. So I said, all right, he's a big guy, so... So I ran into her one day. We both worked in the hospital, and I ran into her up on OBGYN. I don't know if that's significant, but Freud would probably think so. But I said to her, I said, are you busy Saturday night? And she said, no, I'm not. And I said, would you like to go out with me? And that old fear, that thing that kept me from ever taking risks in life, jumped in there. And it says, oh, you probably aren't. And even if you were, you wouldn't want to go out with me anyway. And I turned around and walked away. Now, that was the way I was when I was 15 years old, and that's the way I was when I was 30 years old. That's the kind of fear I'm talking about. And the problem with that fear in me was that I used other people. I made other people make me do things that I was afraid to do myself. I used people. I used the Marine Corps. I joined the Marine Corps and I used them. I would volunteer to go places so they could send me places so I could overcome my fear. It's the craziest thing in the world. I thought that the way you dealt with fear was you forced yourself to be brave. I had a horrible fear of height. So I'm in the Marine Corps and I sign up to go to jump school. So I figure if I jump out of enough airplanes, I won't be afraid anymore. You have to face your fear. Well... Fortunately, I'd busted a kidney up a couple of months before overcoming another fear, so they wouldn't let me go to jump school. But they sent me to mountain climbing school. So I spent about a month in the Sierra Nevadas in the middle of winter, rappelling off the sides of mountains with my eyes closed. So I came back from that experience more afraid of height than I was when I went. See, and that's what happens when you try to be brave to overcome fear. Well, you see, one day I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was sober 6 months, and I was in France studying, one of those coincidences that happen after you start working this program. And my sponsor happened to come through Paris. You know, he traveled around a lot, and he happened to be coming through Paris. And so he took me down to a beautiful cathedral called Chartres. And we took the train down together, and we got off the train, and we were walking through the square. And he said to me, he said, you know, Keith, he said, we can go up. There's a catwalk up the top of this cathedral, and we can look out over the cathedral. And right away, my heart was in my throat. And I said to him, I began to try to get brave, but I'd learned in 6 months something about how you do things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said to me, I said to him, Dan, I can't do that, you see. I said, I have a terrible fear of height. And to the best of my knowledge, that's the first time I ever told a human being that. And he smiled and he said, oh, you have the old I'm afraid of height problem, huh? He said, a lot of us have had that. And he said, you don't need to go up there. He said, or you could go part way. There's a novel concept. He said, or you can go until you get afraid, and then you can take my hand and we'll go further. And that's the difference between being alone and afraid and being an Alcoholics Anonymous in dealing with this soul sickness called fear. And it's true of virtually everything in my life. I have an overwhelming tendency in AA. It's a friend of mine who passed away last year, a wonderful, dear, dear man named Dick Corcoran, who was sober a long time and a dear friend of mine for over 20 years. But Dick always says, my most persistent old idea is that I think I know what's best for me. And my most persistent old idea is that I know what's best for me. And I was cured of that early on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was told very, very early. See, I was one of those people who belonged to the problem of the month group. You know, there are a lot of them around now, you know. Does anybody have a problem? You know, meetings now aren't, they're no longer meetings. We don't spend a lot of time where I'm from discussing the tools of sobriety. We spend a lot of time discussing problems, you know, so we can all agree on how tough it is. And, you know, what? Really, some of you come in and say, does anybody here have a problem? And some of you will put their hand up and they'll say, yes, my mother had a square nipple. And everybody will say, oh, that's a problem. That's a real problem. And so 50 untrained psychiatrists will sit around and talk about the significance of problems. And, you know, but so I had all these problems and no place to take them because the old timers weren't interested in problems unless they needed a laugh. And but I'd find an old timer from time to time and I'd tell the old fool a problem I had. And finally he said to me, he said, I know what you need to do. He said, you need to get some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. And he said, go home and write on the mirror, Keith, you're wrong. And I said to him, I said, well, you see, I can't do that because my problem is I have a poor self-image and I need to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. He'd say, borrow. I said, okay. So I went out and I bought some lipstick. I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman. So I went out and I bought some lipstick and I went home and I wrote on a mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I was absolutely disgusted with this. You know, I threw the lipstick away and everything, and I went off to bed, and I was sober about 60 days. Remember 60 days? Oh. It was like a normal night, you know. I laid down, and for the first time that day, my brain woke up. And it took off, you know. Had a lot of time to make up, And it began to talk to me. It began to say, you're never going to make it, you know. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent, you know. You know, tomorrow they're going to find out what a phony you are. They're not going to let you back in AA. And you're going to go to work tomorrow, and they're going to fire you because they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job. And what difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt, and they don't pay you enough money. And just on and on, and, you know. And I'd toss and turn and everything, and then I'd finally drift off to sleep, and then the leg cramps would come. Remember the leg cramps? Oh, God. I mean, you know, I'd just be standing next to my bed with no idea how I got there. Jumping up and down on one foot. And then just before it was time to go to work, I'd fall sound asleep. Sound asleep. You know? And I had 3 clocks set. And everybody in the neighborhood was up, and I'd finally wake up, you know, and depression was waiting for me, and it would jump on me. And I'd go out in the kitchen, and I'd start making coffee, and I was saying, you know, you still live on Skid Row. You live in a basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. Look at you. What a loser you are. You're going to be 30 years old pretty soon. What a loser you are. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. And I just felt like slashing my wrists. And I walked into the bathroom, and on the mirror it said, Keith, you were wrong. I said, Well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble, you know. But you know what was amazing about that? At the very next opportunity, I needed to be right. I just absolutely needed to be right. I don't want to be that way, but that's the way I am. I think it's part of bondage to self. And I think it's woven through that fabric called fear. Because somehow, somewhere along the line, I got the impression is if you're right, if you're wrong so many times, God's going to say, that's it. Get off the earth. You've used all of yours up. Get out of here, you know. And I only have one or two left. And that's the way I hold on to things. It's just an amazing phenomenon to me. But, you know, it's not because I wasn't surrounded by people who were spiritually well. It's not it at all. I mean, my whole life I've been surrounded by spiritual dynamos. I really have. I have a mother who raised 11 of her own children and then raised kids who didn't have any place else to go. And never, ever did anything but smile. Every day I've ever been in her presence, she puts her arms around me, she'd give me a hug and a kiss, and she'd say, I love you. If you come to my house and she knows you 5 minutes, she'll put her arms around you, she'll give you a hug and a kiss, and she'll tell you she loves you. She had heart surgery this past January up in Pittsburgh, and we were all up there. And here's a woman who never finished high school until all of her children did, and then went back and finished high school and took a college entrance exam and scored higher than any of us. She said, why not? I've been through high school 11 times already. And she was cracking jokes and telling jokes. And they were wheeling her in for surgery, very serious surgery. She was about half hopped up on whatever they gave her. And she said, every day when we sat down at breakfast, we would have rules of grammar. And she said to Julia, she said, calls her Face. She said, I love you, Face. And she told us all she loved us. And then she said, remember, boys, say your prayers and never, never, never end a sentence with a preposition. You should have seen the doctor's face. I had a father who I would have told you never told me he loved me. See, he never told me he loved me. He was a man who raised all of these children. The day he was married, he sold a car. And he didn't have a car until we were all raised and everybody who wanted to go to college went to college. And he never told me he loved me. Every day that I would allow him, he'd spend time with me. Take me to the ball field. He'd come home from the factory, tired. He was a machinist. And he'd go home and the normal thing is he'd sit down with a heated needle and he'd take the pieces of steel out of his finger and then we'd have something to eat and then we'd go to the ballpark. And we'd play baseball and it was down by the factory, down by the steel mill and sometimes we'd be coming back up and they had a dining car down by the factory where the men would come in and out of the factory and they would stop and eat. We'd say to him, Dad, can we have a pop? And pop was 6 cents. And he'd say, well, let me see. And it'd be me and Dumb Danny and my dad. And he'd say, well, let me see. And he'd drop back a little bit. And what he was doing was counting his change. If he had 18 cents, he'd say, well, why don't we have a pop? And we'd go down and Dad would get a root beer and I'd get an orange and Danny would get a grape. And sometimes we'd sit up at the counter like the men did before they went to work. You know, sometimes he'd be coming down the railroad tracks and we'd say, Dad, can we have a pop? And he'd say, yeah, why don't you and Denny get one and I'll take a drink of yours. I'm not very thirsty. And those were the days he had 12 cents. And some days he'd say, let's go home. Maybe your mom made some iced tea or some Kool-Aid and she looked kind of lonely. She probably would like us to come home and be with her. And those were the days he was broke. But he never told me he loved me. And I would have sat on a bar stool next to you and whined and groaned and moaned. And the pity is if it weren't for you and Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have died never knowing how much I was loved. When you're spiritually ill, spiritual giants are frightening. They're not inspiring. They're frightening. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would listen to people like Clancy and people talk who were very spiritual people, and they would frighten me. And the way I would react to them wasn't by saying I'm afraid. The way I'd react to them is I'd sit in the back and make snide comments about them, and I'd criticize them, and I'd ridicule them. And I might even, you know, worry about the syntax and all of that, you know. But most of all, I'd sit back there saying, you know, I ought to be up there. I ought to be up there. What that was being afraid. That's what that was. It was being afraid. And I was surrounded by people who I know now I was afraid of. So the only thing I could do was ridicule them. I remember one I like to talk about from time to time. Sister Victoria was a nun who was a librarian in a little high school I went to. And she was a sweet old lady who would run around and say absolutely ridiculous things. And she not only said stuff, she believed it. That's what really bothered me. She said things like, you know, every boy is a prince and every girl's a princess because we have a father who's a king. And it would terrify me because I don't know what was expected of a prince, for crying out loud. I mean, I wasn't even doing well as a poor kid. I was, I had all sorts of F's in conduct and all that stuff. I mean, what on earth does a prince do? So what I would do, of course, is ridicule her. And I used to serve detention with Sister Victoria, and Sister Victoria would put me behind the magazine rack in the library because she said, though I was a prince, I was contagious and tended to be disruptive. And I'd sit back there and make rosary beads. You know, she'd give me wire and beads. And, you spend enough time with Sister Victoria, you got good at making rosary beads. And so I'd make these rosary beads. And then she would take the rosary beads and she'd send them all over the world to the missions. Now, being an insecure fellow who needed to make his mark, my rosary beads are different than other people's rosary beads. Instead of having 10 beads in each decade, I would put 11 in. And by the time I graduated from high school, there were hundreds and hundreds of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And just before I graduated, this saintly, saintly woman set me down. And I was going to tell her what I had done because you can't let idiots like her not know how clever you've been. Somehow it doesn't count if they don't know. And I said, do you know what I've been doing the last few years? And she said, yes, you sly prince, I know what you've been doing. She said, you've been putting extra beads in all the rosary decades. And she said, I know why you've been doing it too. And I remember thinking, God, I hope she tells me, because I haven't the foggiest idea why I do these things. And she said, you know, you're doing it so that people will pray extra prayers and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that? And you know what she did? She took both of my hands in her hands and she looked me in the eyes and she said, you know, you're a very, very special little prince. And, you know, growing up, I had had a speech impediment. I couldn't be understood very well and had to work very hard at learning to talk. And so the thought of ever talking to people would have been terrifying to me. And she said, one day God's going to send you all over the place. And he's going to give you the opportunity to tell people how much he loves them. And it just scared me to death. And she said, when I first met you, I knew you were special. And she said, so I put this little medal on my beads. And he wore those long beads, you know, so they could bang them against the desk when you're taking tests. And she put a medal of St. Jude on there, which is a patron saint of lost causes. And she said, every time I get to this bead, I pray for you, or this medal, I pray a special prayer for you. And it terrified me. I don't like spiritual people. And the sicker I got, the more frightening they became to me. It's not a surprise to me that people in AA are so hard on religious people, regardless of what what Bill W. said in the big book. We're to be quick to see how they're right. And for, you know, certainly before I got sober and for a long time after I was sober, I was very quick to see how they were wrong. I was very quick to see how they were hypocrites and everything. And you know, that's what I did with the whole world. I would watch you and I'd watch you and I'd watch you, and you would have one chink in your armor, one chink, and it was enough for me to use it to discount you. I went to my 25th high school reunion. You know, when you're spiritually ill, it's easy to sort of idolize people. It's just the wrong ones often. But I'd idolize people, and they didn't know I was idolizing them. I mean, I gave job descriptions to people they had no idea they had. And, you know, they'd let me down, and I'd never forgive them. I went to my 25th high school reunion, and Julia and I were engaged at the time, and we went up, and I said, I hope Richard's here. I owe him an amends. I've got him on my eighth-step list, and I don't know where he is, and I hope I... And sure enough, Richard was there, and so he came, and he was one of those bums that hadn't changed, you know, in 25 years. And so I said, you got a minute, Richard. And Richard was a guy who was a year older than the rest of us. He and Tommy stayed in the third grade an extra year, and they were big guys, and we asked them why they stayed in the third grade an extra year, and he said they wanted to wait for our class because they liked our class better than the other class. And big guys don't lie, so I believed him. And so I began to idolize this guy, and I'd play ball with him, and he'd always choose me to be on his team. And I was a good athlete, but he was a great athlete. And one day, a new guy came to town, and he wanted to welcome him in, so he got him on the team. You know, in the eighth step, it says that we go back as far as our minds can carry us. And, you know, I had to go back to this time. And I remember how crushed I was. So I did two things about it. Number one, I punished the man who chose me on the wrong team by dropping a couple passes. And number two, I punished Richard by shutting him out of my life. And he wanted to be my friend, and I shut him out of my life. And he came to me, and I wouldn't play ball. And he came to me about 2 days later at lunchtime, and he said to me, Keith, I've got an extra Twinkie. Do you want my Twinkie? Now, a kid never had an extra Twinkie. And I said, you don't want it? And he said, no, I'd like you to have it. I said, you sure you don't want it? He said, I'm positive. I couldn't eat it. And I threw it on the ground and stepped on it, and I walked away. Now, you might say, well, that's what a 10-year-old or 12-year-old kid does. But I did that when I was 29 years old. I did. I did that to everybody in my life who I felt ever let me down. You got one chance. I knew nothing of compassion. I knew nothing of forgiveness when it applied to you, but I wanted it for me. And I found Richard, and I went over and I explained. I said, Richard, I said, I got to make amends to you. He said, Keith, I haven't seen you for 25 years. I said, remember when Robert so-and-so moved to town? He said, yeah. And I said, and you picked him on the football team? And he said, yeah, and you took my Twinkie and you threw it on the ground and stepped on it. You know? So this behavior does affect other people. I was like a tornado going through life. You know, I graduated from high school, and it was time to go out into the world. And I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I thought everybody knew what they wanted to do except me. And so I decided that if you don't know what you're going to do, you better do it out of town, and then people won't know you don't know what you're going to do, and you can't look bad in town. You got to get out of town, and so I took an inventory. I stood in front of the mirror and I flexed my muscles, and I was about 5 feet 1 inches tall, and I weighed 113 pounds, and whatever else I was a born killer. So so I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. It just seemed like the right thing to do, and my parents were a little upset. Mom cried all night, and she kept saying, Scott, they'll kill him. And my dad kept saying, don't worry, Pat, they won't take him. And so the next day, they took me over to Wheeling, and I got on a bus, and I went to Pittsburgh. Now, it's 60 miles away, and it's the second longest trip I'd ever taken in my life. Once I'd gone to Cleveland, but the game was rained out. And I'm 17 years old. I'm filled with fear. I never learned the real trick to humility, which is to ask questions. And I'm launched into a world I knew nothing about and thought I was supposed to. What a prescription for disaster. And it was a very bad year. And the Marine Corps took you if you had a pulse. And in that afternoon, I was sworn in the United States Marine Corps. And that evening, I went off to a bar in Pittsburgh. And you know what happened? The miracle happened. And Clancy talked last night, I never had a period of normal drinking. I'm convinced of that now. I walked into a bar in Pittsburgh. I was terrified. There were three other guys from Pittsburgh who joined the same time, and I just followed them in there. I didn't know what else to do. We had 8 hours till the train left, and the place was filled with real men, you know, the kind. And they all had real women with them. You know, real women hang around with real men. There's some out there now. And a real man bartender came over and said, "What do you want?" I thought, "Oh, God, a quiz." You know? And I didn't know how to answer that question, so I watched the other people, and they ordered a beer, so I did too. And then he came back and asked the same question and got the same answer. And somewhere between the second and third beer, my life changed. And if you're alcoholic, you know precisely what I'm talking about. My life changed very, very dramatically. I knew things I never knew before. And I felt things I never felt before. Not just the presence of good things, but more importantly was the absence of bad things. All of a sudden, I knew what I needed to know about life. I knew the big picture. I knew about how to be a real man. I knew about women. I knew about politics. I knew about the Marine Corps. I knew about everything. And I went from table to table and explained to these people in this bar. Because after the third beer, this bar was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling men. And all of them had women with them were looking at me with those hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And the time came to get on the train, and I staggered to the train, and I got on the train, and I had a blackout, and I wet my pants, and I did all this stuff I was to do. But small price to pay to go to Pittsburgh. That was the most magnificent time of my life. And my drinking was pathetic. It was like Doug said, it was nothing glamorous about it. I drank wherever I could, whenever I could. I got into a lot of trouble with it and all the rest of it. But what was important about it wasn't what happened. What was important was the goal. The goal was always to get back to Pittsburgh. If I could just get back to Pittsburgh, that time when it was perfect. And you know, I could never do it. I approached it numerous times. I could get to the suburbs. But I couldn't get back to Pittsburgh. I couldn't get that feeling that had been there before. Somebody said to me one time after I was sober, "What did it cost you to be an alcoholic?" You know, only a non-alcoholic would ask a question like that. You know, because it costs whatever it costs. I mean, that's the silliest thing in the world. I mean, you know, one day, you know, I loved the Marine Corps. I loved everything about it. I worked hard. I got meritorious promotions. I got Dress Blues Award off of Paris Island. I got an appointment to go to Officers Candidate School. I gained 30 pounds and grew a few inches. I mean, incredible things happened to me during that time, and I loved the Marine Corps. But you know, I got out. And the reason I got out was because I began to violate virtually every principle associated with the Marine Corps. I went from this guy who wanted it more than anything in the world to the guy who drank on duty, who led a patrol in a combat zone in a blackout. I violated virtually every principle associated with the Marine Corps. And the only thing left for me to do was to blame the Marine Corps for what had happened to me. I was victimized by the Marine Corps. And I got out. As I had been victimized by the church I grew up in. As I had been victimized by the family I came out of. And that was my pattern. I would find something I loved, I would throw myself into it, I'd throw myself into it wholeheartedly, and then I'd begin to violate all the principles associated with that way of life. And when it got bad enough that I couldn't stand it anymore, I would run away and I would blame that way of life for what happened to me. That's my alcoholism. It's no more dramatic than that. It's really rather pathetic. I think the most pathetic thing that can happen to a human being is that they have a program that guarantees that they'll hate themselves more this time next year than they do this time this year. And that's what alcoholism is. It's a perfect program. It'll guarantee that you hate yourself and you're more disgusted with yourself this time next year than you are now. That's alcoholism. Now, of course, since AA is the opposite of alcoholism, AA is a program that guarantees that if you do what you're told to do and you don't drink and you work these steps and you get actively involved and you read the literature, you'll think more of yourself this time next year than you do this time this year. And I know that's true because it's happened to me for over 21 years now. I don't putt as well as I like, and my mustache is a little grayer than it used to be, but you know, I'm more the man and the human being and the husband and the employee and the boss and the son and the brother and the friend. I'm more what I want to be this year than I was this time last year. And that's the great promise of the spiritual existence in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just sort of like a ball in a pinball machine bounced from thing to thing until the string ran out for me. And it happened for me on May the 13th, 1973. I was living in a basement of a place in Washington, D.C., and I walked into what served as a bathroom, and it was truly a dive. And I began to take my life. And something stopped me. It was a voice of a woman. I won't go into all that. Doesn't matter to me now. If it matters, do you ask me? But I heard the voice of a woman. And it was a very clear voice, and she told me not to do it. And she also reminded me that there were two phone numbers that my ex-wife had given me. It was just, boom, it was like that. I realized my estranged wife had given me two phone numbers when she asked me to leave. She said, I can't help you. Maybe they can. Later, I found out from her that the two phone numbers, one was to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then the other one was to a little treatment center outside of Washington, D.C. Now, when I read the speaker's manual, one of the things I'm obliged to do at this time is to say something very negative about treatment centers. It says, page 14, it says, put down treatment centers and anybody else who ever attempted to help a suffering alcoholic. Say something nice about Calverts and bartenders. I don't understand it, but those seem to be the rules. But I got to tell you, I can't do that. I can't do that simply because the number I found was the one to the treatment center. Now, I don't know if I'd gotten sober without it. I have the foggiest notion if I'd have gotten sober without it. But what I know is I called that number. I went there. After 3 days of detoxing on my own, I went there. I haven't had a drink since. Now, I know people who say, at least I didn't go to that damn treatment center. Now, I slipped around for 15 years, but by damn, I didn't get any help from them. I don't know about that. What I know is what happened to me. So you can't applaud the fact that I hate treatment centers. I don't. I went to this place, and it's not there anymore, and it doesn't matter whether it's there or not. It really doesn't matter. It was just a pathway to getting me to you. And they put me on a little bus and they drove me off to a meeting, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was absolutely terrified. I was, all the fear was like raw at this point. I was nothing but fear. And I walked up to the door and an old man stood at the door, an old timer, the one I used to go back and give him a lot of laughs later on. And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, "You're new, aren't you?" And I thought, my God, he's psychic. How does he know that? And suddenly I realized why. You know, one time I was with my daughter Kimberly, went to a conference out in Colorado, and we met in Denver, and we took one of those little hedge hoppers, you know. And I do not like to fly on airplanes. Better with them, without them, but I don't like to fly with them. And so we're flying over the mountains, and, you know, they have to find air pockets around there to fly through so they can bounce enough to make you feel like you got your money's worth. And Kimberly said to me, "You don't like to fly, do you, Dad?" And I said, "Well, what makes you say that, honey?" And she said, "Well, we've been flying for a half an hour and you haven't blinked yet." So I probably didn't blink the first two or three meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there I was. Incredible thing happened to me. He shook my hand, and he shook it in a very, very warm way, and he looked deep inside of me, and he said, "Son, you keep coming here, you never have to drink again." And that could never happen for me. But it did. And he introduced me to an old woman in that meeting who got me a half a cup of coffee and put her arm around me and patted me through the whole meeting. And halfway through, she looked at me and that old face smiled and she said, "Son, you keep coming here, you'll never be alone again unless you want to be." And I have and I haven't been alone since. I don't know why Alcoholics Anonymous took with me. If you were to predict, there was nothing in my life that would have caused you to predict that it would have worked for me, except I had a mother and a father and brothers and sisters and Sister Victoria and all those people who I know prayed for me. When I go to on a 12-step call and I'm talking to this sick drunk, I try not to predict, because all I'm seeing is the product of alcoholism. What I'm not seeing is what's at work spiritually that I can't picture, because I don't have the eyes to see this stuff or the ears to hear it. What I don't see is the mother and a father and a wife or the husband or whoever it is that's praying for this person. I don't know how many angels have been sent to help on this particular case. I don't know who's behind all of this. All I can see is the result of the disease. So I can't think of any other reason. You know, I had a grandmother who was a periodic alcoholic. In the last 6 or 7 years of her life, she didn't drink. And good old Granny was one of my favorite people. And Granny was locked up the last time. She was 73 years old. She was locked up for breaking the arm of a guy who's 35 years old with a bar stool. And now, all of a sudden, Granny stopped drinking, and nobody knows why. You know, and I was sober 6 months when Granny died, and Granny didn't know that she'd been pretty sick, and she didn't know that I had gone to AA. But you know, the last thing Granny said in Wheeling, West Virginia, she's dying in a hospital, and she said to my mother, her youngest daughter, she said, "You know, I'm sorry for the things I did and didn't do, and maybe I didn't tell you I loved you enough, but I do," and on and on. And the last thing she said was, "Don't you worry about Keith. He won't have to drink anymore." I don't know how these things work. I'd like to sit around and think I have an explanation for all this stuff. When I hear these people much brighter than me talk about the steps and how they work, and I do, you know, I try to think about how the steps work. The factor that I can never factor into this thing, the great unknown, is God and the spiritual program. And the people I know who are sober the longest don't talk about the dynamics anymore. They talk about God. And that's why they seem simple-minded. They're not simple-minded. They have just learned to keep it simple, and I recognize that now. You know, I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. I threw it myself in as only the dying can. And most of the time, I didn't like it. If you're new and you don't like it, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter whether or not you like it. It only matters that you do it. I know people who agree with every jot and tittle in a big book, and they died drunk because they don't do it. I know people who've been sober a fairly long time. They don't believe any of that stuff, but they do it. Now, if you point it out to them, they'll get very upset with you. So let them think they're not doing it, but they're doing it. You know, so much has been said about so many aspects of this thing this weekend, and I've got so much to take home with me. And let me tell you a little bit about what happened to me in this ninth step, just a few instances, and then I'll sit down and shut up. You know, I made amends to that father who never told me he loved me, and it was sometime. I have a little house down on the ocean that Julia and I are now living in, Carolina Beach, and my dad had never seen the ocean. You know, when you're raising that many kids and you're as far as 300 miles away from the ocean, you don't go see the ocean, and if you don't have a car and things. And so we took him down to see the ocean some years back, shortly after he retired, and he just stood there and watched it go in and out. And he said, "Does it just keep doing that?" And I said, "As far as I know, Dad." And I had to move away for a couple of years to do a project, and Dad said to me, "You know, your mom and I know you're probably worried about what's going to happen to your house. We'll keep an eye on it for you." So they moved to North Carolina, and they kept an eye on my house for about 6 years. And I'd go see him and talk. And finally, I approached him, and I made that amends to him. And I discovered how very, very wrong I'd been. He said to me, he said, "I'm glad we're having this talk, son." He said, "You know," he said, "remember when you first went to work?" And I said, "Well," he said, "you always work, but remember your first job?" And I said, "Well, yeah, Dad." I said, "Pins in a bowling alley." I said, "I was probably about 13. He said, "You were 12. And he said, "Remember your first day at work?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so." He said, "Well," he said, "I took you to lunch." I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "I took you to Louis' hot dog stand." He said, "Do you remember what you had?" And I said, "Probably a hot dog and an orange pop." He said, "No." He said, "You had a root beer." He said, I think you thought men who worked drank root beer. He said, and then I talked to you about giving a man a good day's work for a good day's pay. And he said, I took you down to the bus stop because the bowling alley was in the next town. And he said, I said to you, son, do you want me to come with you? And you said, no, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, Keith, you got on the bus? And he said, I stood there and I watched till the bus was out of sight and you never looked back. He said, I never felt from that time on I ever had a right to say anything to you again. He said, all your brothers and sisters let me help them through college and things, and you never did. You did it all by yourself. And I thought I was being responsible. And you know, what the big book says is true in the 12 and 12. Most people treat me the way I force them to treat me. He loved me desperately and always did. And I rarely gave him the opportunity to tell me. I got in a car one day and I drove to where Dumb Denny was living. And we began to talk. And I told Denny, I said, you know, Den, I said, I owe you an amends. I said, because every chance I've gotten, I've said things that detract from you. And I said, and you're a fine man, and you don't deserve that. I said, so for the last 6 months, every opportunity I've had with the family, I've said positive things about you. I said, because I've always been afraid of you, because you always do things so well. And I always thought I looked so bad compared to you. And Dan started to laugh. He said, if you owe me an amends, then I owe you an amends. He said, you know, Keith, he said, most of my life I've been afraid. He said, once I started something, I was afraid to quit. He said, I've always envied you. He said, because you never gave a shit about anything. He said, if things weren't going well in one state, you go to another state. He said, hell, you go to another country. And he said, you went to Skid Row and you came back. He said, you lost a wife and your children and you came back. He said, I admire you more than any man in the world. And I found out that we're not better or worse. We're just different. You know, one day I took a look at my dislike and my criticism of spiritual people. And I went down to a retreat center. And Sister Victoria wasn't there, but there was an old priest there who was sitting in a rocking chair reading. And I approached him and I said, Father, could I have a few moments of your time? I need to talk to you. And I sat down in a rocking chair next to him, across from him, and we began to rock and to talk. And I told him how critical I had been. And I'd even gone back sober and gotten a degree in theology just to prove how wrong these guys were. And I told him about all the critical things I'd said about him and how I ridiculed him and everything. And before I was finished, he stopped me. And he got up and he pulled me up and he put his arms around me and began to pat me. And he said, son, he said, stop. He said, it isn't you who owe me an amends, it's I who owe you an amends. He said, I don't have long to live because I have an illness. He said, and I was just sitting here talking to my higher power. And I was asking him, what didn't I do that I should have done? He said, I've been a priest for 50 years. And he said, I realize that too many times in those 50 years, I didn't do what my higher power said. My higher power told me to leave the 99 that agreed with me and liked me and to go out after the one that was lost. And he said, I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone. And I learned a great truth about spiritual people, and that is that they do the best they can with what they've got. And then I went to see my mother, who has been very, very ill. And she was one of the first people that I made an amends to. And what she did was just wanted to know that I wouldn't kill myself with alcohol. And she was always trying to fix things, and she was always trying to manipulate things, and she always had to be the center of attention. And one day she began to talk to me about what it was like growing up with alcoholism. And she said to me, she said, I know I'm a pain in the ass a lot of the times. She said, but you know, I remember when I was 13 years old, she said, Mother would go on binges. She said, I always knew when Mother was going to drink. And she said, so what I'd do is she said, I took a hammer and nails and I'd roll them up in a blanket and I'd put them under my mattress. And she said, mother might not come home for days, sometimes weeks, but when she came home, she always brought a man with her. And she said, what I'd do then is I'd lock my door, but that would never stop them. She said, then I'd go out on the stoop and I'd nail the window shut so they couldn't get to me. And I said to her, how fearful you must have been to watch your son be that drunk for that long. Will you allow me to include you in recovery? And you know, every year I send a chip to my mom and my dad. And one year they were coming to visit, so I thought I'd just hang on to it. And they came and visited, and they went back home, and I'd forgotten to give it to them, and I got a call. And mom said, you know, I put in a whole year. I deserve a chip. And, you know, May the 13th of this year, I sent her a chip with 21 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the freedom to do the right thing. All I ever wanted to do was the right thing. I was afraid and I was sick. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm given that freedom. You know, if you're new and you're kind of confused, don't try to understand this stuff. I don't know that I understand it. Just do it. Just do it. Reach out. I was sober about 2 months, and if you're having a lot of thinking problems and you're confused a lot, please don't let it bother. I was sober about 2 months, and I got up one morning, I got ready to go to work, and I was driving to work, and I forgot where I worked. This is a true story. I couldn't remember where I worked. But I always carried a card with a dime taped to it that my sponsor gave me, and it had his office number and had his home number, and I called him. Now, I didn't want Dan to know that I didn't know where I worked, because I didn't want Dan to think I was sick, because I didn't think he'd want to sponsor anybody who was sick. So, but what I said to him, I called him up and I said, Dan, how are you? He said, well, I'm fine, Keith. He said, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. I said, I was just wondering how you're doing. He said, well, what's all that noise? I said, well, I'm calling you from a phone booth. He said, your car break down? I said, no, Dan, car's fine. I'm just wondering how you were doing. So finally he said, what's the problem, buddy? And I said, well, Dan, I said, it's not much of a problem. I said, I just can't seem to remember where I work. And you know what he said? He said, you got the old I can't remember where I work problem, huh? He said, a lot of us have had that. And I got to tell you, I've never met anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who forgot where they work, but... And he said to me, he said, you know, he said, it's scary, isn't it? And I said, it really is. And he said, I know about being afraid, too. And he said, I promise you that if you keep coming to meetings and you keep making phone calls and you work the steps and you do the things it says to do in that book, I promise you that fear will be gone one day. And I said, really? He said, really. And he said, may I make a suggestion? And I said, anything. He said, if you ever have this problem again, if you can remember to look on the front bumper of your car, you have a parking sticker. And I drove to work thinking, where do these people learn these things? You know, I was sober about 90 days. Something that Clancy mentioned last night reminded me of this. I hadn't talked about it in a long time, but I was sober about 90 days, and I worked in a genetics laboratory at Georgetown University, and I'd go get samples for different things and run tests and genetic tests and things. And I went in, and there was a woman there, a beautiful woman who had red hair, and... they were doing a bone marrow on her, and I went to get some marrow to run tests, and she was frightened, as she should be, and it's a painful thing. And she said to me, she picked me out, I guess, and she said, you know, it's not fair. She said, it's not fair I have this disease. And I was thinking, you know, it's not fair that I have this disease either. And she said, you know, my husband couldn't take this, and he took the kids and left. And I'm thinking, you know, my wife took my kids and left. And then she said, I'm 29 years old. And I was thinking, I'm 29 years old. And she said, I'll do anything if I could be better. And about 2 months later, she had died. And 2 months later, I was sober for 5 months. It's so very simple, isn't it? It's so very, very simple. All I have to do is to be willing to do whatever it takes. And I am guaranteed a life not without pain. Who would want a life without pain? I wouldn't be a human being then. I would never change. Not a life without concern or worries or bad things. That's not it. I have a dear friend who I hadn't seen in a lot of years, and I saw him a little while back, and Bob P. And Bob's having a very difficult time now. And I know some people here are going to go see him, and I hope they'll take him my love. And this morning at Mass, I prayed for him too. But I hope that I can deal with life and death with the style and the grace of the people I've seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. You live it so well, and I want to spend the rest of my life around you. I am most grateful for the opportunity to come and be with you. Julie and I are very, very grateful, and I thank you very much.